Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of all of our hundreds of past programs at radioinvivo.net. The Burroughs Welcome Fund is a Golden Voices underwriter here on WCOM and Radio In Vivo. The Burroughs Welcome Fund supports excellence in science education across North Carolina. The fund believes that providing students with engaging and interactive curriculum helps to spark curiosity for careers in science, mathematics, and technology. You can learn about education grant opportunities for North Carolina schools and teachers at www.bwfund.org. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a nonprofit science center dedicated to cross-disciplinary research in evolution. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, NCABR's mission has been to promote public understanding of and support for bioscience research and careers. NCABR offers many resources for both researchers and K-12 science teachers, including conferences and free professional development workshops. To learn more, visit ncabr.org. Radio In Vivo is proud to acknowledge the underwriting support of our friend, Mr. Steve Brockman. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by Steve for the advancement of science and education. It's also a great pleasure to acknowledge the underwriting support of Dr. Bob Conder and Dr. Elena Conder at Carolina Neuropsychological Service in Raleigh. They specialize in assessing and treating brain disorders. You can learn more about Carolina Neuropsychological Service at carolinacns.com. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by Chapel Hill Eye Care, located at 235 South Elliott Road in Chapel Hill. Chapel Hill Eye Care provides comprehensive eye care to people of all ages. Healthy eyes for a lifetime. Chapel Hill Eye Care, 919-968-4774. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their support. Well, it's been called one of the jewels in the crown of the life sciences here in the Triangle and across the state of North Carolina. So it is long overdue that we profile the North Carolina J.C. Byrne Center at Chapel Hill and its director, Dr. Bruce Cairns. The Byrne Center is not only a world-class treatment facility, it also sponsors both basic and applied research in burn therapy, rehabilitation, and prevention. Bruce Cairns has been with the Byrne Center since 2000 and has been its director since 2007. He is also the John Stackhouse Distinguished Professor of Surgery and Vice Chair for Research in the Department of Surgery and Professor of Microbiology and Immunology at the UNC School of Medicine, as well as being the Medical Director of Respiratory Care for UNC Healthcare. Bruce received his MD degree from the University of Pennsylvania in 1989 and did his postgraduate training right here at UNC Chapel Hill. He is also very much involved in UNC campus work, and in fact, he was elected to the position of UNC faculty chair this past April, which we will talk about. Bruce, I have to start our conversation with the fact that you're actually the son of UNC teachers and researchers and a 1981 graduate of Chapel Hill High School. So you are an actual Chapel Hill native.
That's right. Go Tigers.
Talk about Tar Heel born and bred, too. Well, Bruce, you have followed a very interesting path to your present specialization and your present position. Can you tell us a little bit about your experiences between Chapel Hill High and where you find yourself today.
Sure, Ernie. It's really great to be here in lovely Carrboro. I remember walking the streets and riding the bikes. And actually, you could rent roller skates on Franklin Street, and we could just run around here all the time as a young person. And I remember over 30 years ago thinking about what is this place and why is Chapel Hill, UNC Chapel Hill, the Research Triangle, Duke, such a unique environment to grow up in, and what opportunities do they provide? And I remember my father was a psychology professor, and he focused on child development and started the Center for Developmental Science, in fact, in collaboration with my mother, who they worked together to collect data on children who are at risk for behavioral problems later on in life. And it's related to the question of nature versus nurture in mm-hmm. terms of what are the determinants for success. And a lot of the work that they showed was that influences in the environment can really have a huge impact on children. And they published several books. And I remember being impressed with this approach to solving really important problems and taking the academic route. And so that was one of the things that we talked about when I was young, is that if you really want to try to solve a problem, you have to understand how to study it and ask it. But try not to be too abstract. Try, and I think, frankly, Ernie, that's probably good for me, because I don't think I'm clever enough to be an abstract thinker. Parenthetically,
I doubt that, but
no, it's true, and I learned this actually quite young, mm-hmm. and what I mean by that is that there are people who are child prodigies in mathematics or in literature or music, and they would end up becoming physicists, theoretical physicists, and I have enormous respect for scientists who've done that, or Oliver Smithies, who's our Nobel laureate at Carolina, talked about his development and the ability to ask the most basic questions and come up with solutions that really are clever and unique and different. And I have to confess, I recognized early that perhaps wasn't going to be my skill, but really being able to look at the problems that are around us and try to come up with some answers. So I went away from I left Chapel Hill in 81 and went to Johns Hopkins as an undergraduate, and didn't really plan on going to medical school. Thought basic science research was just sort of following my parents' footsteps was where I was headed. But I had always been interested in working with people, and so the two converged, and went to medical school. In fact, my father, after he had graduated from Stanford, got his PhD. Did his postdoc at Stanford. I mean, at University of Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. which is one of the attractions for me to go there.
Sure.
And then when I was in medical school, I was very interested in taking care of the critically ill, and for reasons that are not entirely clear to me, surgery. And then from surgery, interest in surgery and applying for surgery residency, we had one of the best training programs here at Carolina. And I matched in that. That's sort of an interesting process to go through the residency match.
Sure. So that was that pure serendipity that you matched at?
Well, not entirely serendipity. You come up with your list, and the institutions come up with their list, and
okay.
you see where the fit is.
Right.
It feels a little bit like a lottery, and uncertainty, because there may be nobody wants you. And that's a challenge, and we have that happen. But things have changed a lot since that process 25 years ago. And when I came to Carolina, one of the first rotations I was on was in the burn center. And I was struck with how challenging the situations were for the patients. And it was odd, because I didn't really think about it, but I remember buying jelly from the JCs in the 70s when the burn center was being built. Never really thinking that I would have an opportunity to be in the place. Mm-hmm. And of course, when you're an intern and a resident, you don't really think very much about that either. You just you're just trying to do the very best you can and learn everything.
Sure.
And I did a couple years of research and then finished residency, and the Navy. I had applied for a naval scholarship because medical school is so expensive, and it's gotten more so. Mm-hmm. But also, I thought that that would be an important giving back service, and frankly, there weren't a lot of other service scholarship opportunities. There are more now than back in the 80s. And then when I finished residency, I was deployed to Guam, and there were a number of real challenges there. We had a plane crash, 747 plane crash, and people were severely injured and burned. Mm-hmm. So it sort of, okay, maybe doing burns is what I'm supposed to do. There was an earthquake where we lost power, and we were hand bagging the patients in the ICU, not knowing how long we could do this.
Sure.
And there was an earthquake where the infrastructure was damaged. And so that ended up being part of my identity. And then when I came back to UNC, looked around the country, where was the best opportunity to really blend all of these interests, scientific interests, clinical interests, and service interests. There's no question that UNC, as Charles Kuralt eloquently described, is the university of the people. And we take that very seriously here. And that was instilled in me at a very young age. And I think that philosophy, which has been part of Carolina's mission for a long time, but past 100 years started by Edward Kidder Graham, is really what makes this such a wonderful university and a great environment for the Burn Center because of its interdisciplinary collaborative nature. And so that's sort of the more of the long, but the long and short of how I got here.
Well, that's a fine story. So you ultimately joined the Burn Center in the year 2000.
That's correct.
And worked your way up to the directorship in 2007. So you've been the director for 7 years now.
That's correct. Gosh, that's right. 7 years.
Hard to believe, I'm sure.
Hard to believe.
Well, Bruce, as I said in my introduction, the Burn Center is really a jewel in the crown for not only UNC and the Triangle, but really for the entire state of North Carolina, as you properly corrected me. 'Cause it does draw patients and serve all of the people of North Carolina, all 100 counties, I'm sure. And as you mentioned, it opened its doors in 1981. But can you fill us in a little bit on some of the history, on how and why the Burn Center was originally established, and, as I say, a little bit of the center's history?
Sure. So it's really a singular event and a single individual who's responsible for the Burn Center, and that's John Stackhouse.
After whom your distinguished professorship.
That's correct.
Yeah.
So John Stackhouse is a remarkable individual. And I think he's 97. He's still alive.
I was going to ask you. He's still with us. That's remarkable.
Yes, he is. He lives down on the coast. And he's brilliant. And he started working on the electrical lines before he graduated high school. And then he went to Clemson University before World War II. And then he was, I don't know if he was drafted or he volunteered, but I think he was in the Seabees, the construction battalions. And then when he came back, he had an opportunity to enter in a number of fields, and he chose to start his own contracting business, electrical contracting business. And he was extremely successful, and this is in Goldsboro. Mm-hmm. But he always was very committed to his employees, and people would get hurt. And when they got hurt badly, electrical injury.
Sure.
And there were really no facilities for his employees to go to. In fact, if you ask him, he says, why did you start the Burn Center? He says, well, because I was in the business of burning people. And he means that.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Because of the environments, the hazardous environments that people had to work in. And so that really bothered him. And so we went around the state because he was an influential business person and was not terribly pleased with the response that he got when asked about how can we improve the care of these people. And so he traveled around the country, went up to Richmond, which is the Medical College of Virginia. It had one of the first civilian burn centers, the Haynes Burn Center. And the whole history of modern burn care is interesting in terms of its relationship between the military and civilian response, because I would say the modern era burn started after the Coconut Grove fire in Boston in 1942, mm-hmm. where hundreds of people were in a nightclub fire, and that was when we recognized how to resuscitate patients and what are the complications that are associated with prolonged trying to keep these people alive. And then the next modern advance was during the Vietnam War, when the development of antimicrobials and a more simpler but more sophisticated approach to resuscitation was developed. And so Mr. Stackhouse traveled to all of these places and asked them, how should we build a burn center? And so Basil Prewitt, who's really considered the grandfather of modern burn care, he was the director of the U.S. Surgical Institute of Research during the Vietnam War and beyond, and he's still alive as well. He actually helped create the burn center here. Mm-hmm. So our lineage extends back to the best and the brightest who developed our modern the modern burn care, and that was due to Mr. Stackhouse. And then he went to the governor and to the legislature and said, we really need to, and the School of Medicine and the university, several of them actually, and said, we need to build this place. And it wasn't entirely clear to them that this was a priority or necessary. So he helped with that as well by enlisting the JCs and the firefighters mm-hmm. and the electrical companies and raised money and did the fundraising drive. It also raised the political capital that really motivated people to say that we could not ignore this tsunami of interest and investment any longer.
Sure.
And it really required that sheer force of will to build what we have today. And parenthetically, I would submit that burns is not one of those fields that comes to people's mind as to, you know, why is this a priority for us? And that's true around the country. There aren't very many burn centers like this. But they serve the most vulnerable. And so this also speaks to something I was taught here in this environment, that when you want to make a difference, find the situation where the resources are the least and the problem is the greatest and the folks who are affected by it don't have a voice. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very true of this community. People think about that a lot. And that's really what drove the burn center. And it still drives a lot of the people who support us. And so whether that's the firefighters or the electrical co-ops, and in fact, we have a wonderful relationship with Duke Energy and the JCs and a number of other individuals. And you can see the drive and the passion they have in making sure that we stay focused. And I'll get back to that in a second. But when Mr. Stackhouse created the Burn Center, his experience of the challenges he had to overcome led him to creating an advisory board. We're going to meet tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And that advisory board, it has people from all over the state who volunteer their time and efforts, just like this wonderful station, because they believe in the mission. They take their job very seriously. It's not just a matter of giving resources and then say, well, let's see what happens next.
Right.
They have a lot of interaction with us, and they say, tell us what you need. Don't tell us you don't have enough. Just make sure that we know what you're doing with this. And as much as I'm interested in talking to you, Dr. Cairns, I really need to talk to patients, nurses, therapists, and hear what they're saying. Because frankly, they'll be as open. They'll say, frankly, we don't believe you. We need to hear from them. And they'll also say, if you don't believe in our mission or you lose sight of our mission, that's okay. We'll find somebody else. Mm-hmm. And so that structure, what it does is it ensures that if you support this enterprise, that there's this oversight that really makes sure that we're staying focused. So reach for the stars, great, but keep your feet planted firmly on the ground.
Absolutely. Well, Bruce, how has the center grown and progressed in the 3+ decades that it's been in existence?
So over the past 15 years or so, our volume has increased about 2.5-fold. So I would say when I came back, we had maybe 200, 300 admissions. which is the standard for most burn centers across the nation. Last year, we had over 1,400. We'll probably have nearly 1,500 admissions. That's one of the largest, busiest burn centers in the nation. Even with that, still, people in our state, only 60% of the people who get admitted with a burn come to a burn center. And that's a real problem. Mm-hmm. Because of the specialized services, not just the physicians or not even necessarily the physicians, but the nurses and the therapists as well. And so as a result of that volume growth and service growth, we've had to work with the hospital, work with the university and the School of Medicine, and they've been wonderful, by the way, to expand the clinical the physical footprint. So we have 21 ICU beds and 15 floor beds. The electrical co-op's acute burn wing unit opened a few years ago, and we now have the Duke Energy Family Room, as well as the North Carolina J.C. Burn Center, which originally had 11 ICU beds, now has 21 ICU beds. It's the only unit, intensive care unit, where both adults and children are cared for in the same location. We have a wonderful working relationship with the pediatric intensive care unit and the pediatricians who are involved in this care, as well as with other disciplines. But still, because burns are so dominating a condition, those patients will come to the burn intensive care unit. And so as that has grown, we've had to grow our aftercare programs, because once you've been burned, you're a burn survivor for life.
Sure.
We have 20,000 people in our burn survivor database. You never you always have the scar of a burn injury once you become a burn survivor. Notice I didn't call it burn victim.
Mm-hmm.
The phraseology does matter.
Absolutely.
But if it's not just the physical scar, it's the psychological scars and working with society. So we have a number of disciplines whose role it is to help people integrate back into society, back to work. But this is still an evolving field, because now we've improved survival and hopefully improved physical outcomes, and we need to work on psychological outcomes as well. But we really need to work with our patients and their families to understand what does it mean to do better? What does it mean to be a survivor? And what are the kinds of treatments that really are valuable to you? But we've learned we've learned so much, not just about what it means to be burned, but what it means to be human, to live in our society and the things that we value and judge. And so it's really a fascinating place.
Absolutely. Well, you started to allude to it, but I wanted to ask you, what is the state of the art today in burn treatment? I'm sure it has changed vastly since 1981, when the burn center was established.
That's right. So the major issues were resuscitating patients, which is when they when people get a major burn, it creates a very unique physiologic problem. And we all have heard of shock, hemorrhagic shock when you lose volume, or septic shock or cardiogenic shock when you have a heart attack. Burn shock is very different, and it requires more fluid resuscitation than any other condition in medicine. But it really is it has to be carefully administered over a period of time. And we used to have enormous complications with that process and talked about the concept of failure to resuscitate. We think we no longer have that problem. So that's an improvement. Mm-hmm. The second is inhalation injury is now a major cause of complications.
And that's one of your focuses, right?
That's exactly right, because that's one of the major problems.
Sure.
And so that really requires specialized treatment. We've developed ventilators and antibiotic strategies and ways to clean out the debris that are uniquely different, and we're still working on that process. One of the greatest challenges we still face is in removing the burn wound itself and then replacing it, either with the patient's skin or with some skin replacement. There are a number of very interesting developments that are on the horizons, but we've been saying that for decades. It's also a problem of how expensive some of these treatments are, and you have to be able to sort out, is this truly an advance, or is this an advance for the people who developed it?
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to strike a balance with how much it costs to do some of these things versus how can we make sure that we remain viable as an enterprise to get the very best outcome for as many people as we can.
I see. That's very interesting. have survival rates improved significantly through the years?
Yes. So our survival rate went from about 94% to about 98% over the past 15 years or so. And so it creates some challenges because that means that people who otherwise would not have survived before now are. They stay in the hospital of a long period of time, and then they have to live with the consequences of the injuries.
Sure.
And so that's another area of our research is what does that mean? And how do we deal with the pain and the psychological issues? These are all still being explored. And we have a very active, I think I mentioned earlier, a very active aftercare program. And we're working with our psychiatry and psychology colleagues to sort of help understand, and our rehabilitation colleagues, to help understand what does it mean to have these people survive, and how can we integrate the physical treatment advances with the psychological ones.
And it looks like you also pay a lot of attention to, as you say, aftercare in terms of physical therapy, occupational therapy, respiratory therapy, all those things.
That's right. And so occupational therapy and physical therapy, it's important to mention them separately because the occupational therapists we have are uniquely capable of delivering services. An experienced burn occupational therapist can decrease the need for reconstructive surgery by 50%. A corollary to that is if you're not able to get to one of these therapists, then you may have a non-functional hand, or you may have scars that are extremely debilitating. Mm-hmm. And so being able to come here and work with them, they manufacture their own garments and they have very specialized treatment protocols, is a critical part of what we do at the burn center. And the same thing is true with physical therapy. Because burn patients are so metabolically challenged that one of the ways to help them improve their skeletal muscle mass is movement. But it's a real specialized skill for a burn physical therapist. And so, again, if someone has a serious injury that requires admission and doesn't have that kind of support, and then that's really important. Now, I will tell you just in terms of some of the challenges we face at our burn center is that we got a letter that Medicaid, North Carolina Medicaid, is not going to reimburse burn physical therapy and occupational therapy anymore when they come through our clinic. And so that will have to be something that we have to use charity care through the hospital and so forth. And you may know that that's also been significantly limited by some of the budget cuts. And there is no place else for these people to get this kind of treatment. So we will continue to do it. But this is where partnership with the people who support our mission and our advisory board is important.
Sure.
But at some point, this is really why we need to have support for our public academic hospitals. Sorry for the political
not a bit.
Diversion,
not a
bit. But I think that is an important part of what we try to advocate for, not try to be contentious, but it's a reality that we have to deal with.
Of course. Well, you know, I think most taxpayers would support that in a heartbeat, you know, where maybe there's some question about how much the basketball coach gets paid, but supporting physical therapy for burn patients, that seems like it should be a no-brainer, but
well, it's and in fact, I think that the arguments that the case we try to make is a financial one,
sure.
And that is that getting the proper treatment at the proper time by an expert will not only help the patient improve and do better, but it will cost less because if they don't get that treatment, they will have a complication. They will get readmitted back into the hospital, and we will end up spending, as a society, a lot more.
Right.
And I obviously this case can be made for a number of medical conditions. And I'm sympathetic to the financial arguments and to some of the views that people have about this. But I think if we're going to take that approach, then we should consider all of the data and make sure that we have a sophisticated answer, rather than one that just seems simpler and easier to do because of the consequences.
Right.
will be significant.
And that seems all too common at this point.
There certainly is, we're certainly facing some challenges in making our case right. be heard, yes.
So is there a very significant risk, I assume, of long-term morbidity in these patients?
Yes. It depends on the magnitude of the injury, the age of the patient, the how well they have done with their treatment program. Did they have any other problems, diabetes, or any other medical conditions? Do they have the kind of support that they need at home? And that's not just a matter of having a nurse or a therapist, but a lot of our patients come from not just challenged socioeconomic situations, but also very challenging family dynamics, and that's particularly true for children. We see a lot of we're the major referral center for pediatric burn abuse, and so we have an outstanding child abuse treatment team at UNC we work with very closely. Mm-hmm. And then those children will, decades on, maybe never have thought about or dealt with this, but it was always lingering. And in our aftercare programs, we'll find people 50, 60 years after their injury talking about something for the first time.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And so it might be out of sight, out of mind for us, but not for them. And so, yes, there's a number of challenges. The other is that it's a dynamic response. People may do really well in the beginning, and then we'll lose contact with them and then reemerge, or the opposite. They may not want to have anything to do with us and then eventually come back and see us. And so we do all comers. So one of the interesting ideas that people have is, what do you do when a patient is not compliant? What do you do with a patient who is really problematic for the system? And we never fire a patient, ever, for any reason.
Thank goodness for that.
Ever.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't.
Sure.
Because, A, there's no place else for them to go, and, B, we recognize that this is, for some people, part of the process and part of the challenge they face. Mm-hmm. That kind of an approach, though, creates enormous strain on systems. And so that's why, again, having community support and understanding is so important.
Absolutely. Well, Bruce, you've been quoted as saying that your ultimate goal is to put the burn center out of business.
That's correct.
Tell us a little bit about that and outreach efforts regarding prevention.
Well, Ernest Grant, who is our outreach coordinator, he's been at the Burn Center probably as long as anybody now, over 30 years. He is a remarkable individual, a North Carolina native, and he's been to every county multiple times, every public school multiple times, to really get the message out about burn prevention, because it is one of those out of sight, out of minds, and your life can change in an instant. And when, from a 60,000 foot view, think about the most effective medical research that we've ever had, and that would be a vaccine. Because it's cheap, it's easy, it's effective, and it's eradicated diseases. Burn prevention is a vaccine for burn injury, and that would mean you wouldn't have to come to the burn center anymore. There's plenty of things for us to take care of, by the way.
Right.
And so it's very important that we work with our partners in the fire service and in the public health to identify challenges in the kitchen, grease fires, microwaves, in the workplace, electrical injury, and then behaviors. It would be our preference that people go to the wonderful public run fireworks rather than take the kind of risky behaviors with even just sparklers, which sounds great and innocent and fun until you get burned.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're not trying to dictate to people what they should and should not do, but rather, particularly when it comes to children, how devastating the injuries can be. And we don't let people walk around with a loaded gun.
Mostly.
So, I guess you're right. But again, it's about prevention.
Absolutely. Well, my guest on Radio in Vivo today is Dr. Bruce Cairns, director of the North Carolina J.C. Burn Center at UNC Chapel Hill. Bruce, I wanted to ask you, before we move on to talk about some of the research involved in burn treatment and prevention these days, about a couple of the newer programs at the Burn Center. The Malawi Center that has just been recently opened, and also the Burn Reconstruction and Aesthetics Center, which is a private practice center affiliated with UNC Healthcare, but it's closely tied, I assume, to the Burn Center as well. Could you tell us a little bit about, briefly, about both of those programs?
Sure. I would just say, before we talk about that, that almost everything that we do in the Burn Center, I consider part of our research program.
Okay.
Because the evolution of burn care has been so rapid, and we have seen immediate impact. Well, first of all, the problem is really challenging. And so making an impact becomes clearly obvious that you've made improvements. But then you have to make decisions about how to decide what to do with a particular development. And so for both of these issues, Malawi as well as the Burn Reconstruction Aesthetic Center, those are also primarily research programs as well as educational programs.
Mm-hmm.
So Malawi is possible because of our partnership with UNC Global Health, run by Mike Cohen and Charlie Vanderhorst and Irving Hoffman, who runs the Camuso Central Hospital UNC project that's been there for over 20 years,
mm-hmm.
That has really shown that you can really decrease the maternal transmission of HIV. I mean, truly groundbreaking work. And that was
absolutely
only possible because of their decades-long investment. Burn, 95% of burn injury occurs in the developing world. And while there have been a number of interests in expanding global health to surgery beyond infectious disease, and hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent, there have been very few successful programs in burns. And so we'll talk to universities that have spent a lot of money building a hospital and an operating room. They'll say, well, we can't solve the burn problem. And part of the reason I think that's true is because they don't see burns as an extension of a medical problem.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, surgery is an extension of a medical problem. Trauma is an extension of surgery. Burns is an extension of trauma. So it's like a pyramid. The second issue is that if you're going to address burns in a country like Malawi, where the per capita income is so low and the resources are so limited, you have to be able to make do with what you have a sustainable program that works for the host nation. So interaction with them and really building on what they would like to see is important. The other is you have to address the cultural issues. So in fact, one of our collaborators is Eunice Solly, who's the chair of the African-American and Diaspora Studies Department. She's an expert in Malawian politics. And so being able to work with the Ministry of Health, Ministry of Education is important.
And you just got back from there, right?
Just got back there. Enormous contrasts. So the other aspect to this is having corporate support. So we opened the Johnson & Johnson burn unit at Camuso Central Hospital. And the idea is to create a model where not only can you train people to take care of this, create the infrastructure to take care of it, but you also can train surgeons who then would stay in country rather than leave, which has always been a problem.
Sure.
In training surgeons. So that, and then once you've done that because of that pyramid concept, you've now expanded the healthcare delivery in these other areas remarkably. And so you need to have somebody who runs that, and that's Anthony Charles, who's my colleague. He's a native of Nigeria, and he also has an adjunct appointment in School of Public Health and is a trauma surgeon extraordinaire.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been developing this program. We've been sending our own surgery residents, getting back to the co-ops. They help fund our residents to go down there, as a number of other people have as well. And so we've published a number of papers on our outcomes. In fact, a 50% survival now has gone from a 20% burn to a 40% burn. And in order to really make a difference, and you have to have these sort of goals, but then we follow the model that the UNC Global Project has of this is really as well as is research as much as it is clinical care. Surgery is different than medicine, but it's research.
Sure.
And you have to know how to study that, analyze it, And then be able to write it up. And what we'd like to do is get more grant funding, and that's what we're working on. Now, for the Burn Reconstructive Sex Center, it's actually part of us. It's not a private group. It's part of the Department of Surgery and the School of Medicine.
Okay.
So that was a bold initiative by the department as well as the medical school to do this. It's a new model. But we have the largest, I think, we have the largest laser experience for burn scar modification, I believe, in the world, certainly in the nation. We just presented our most recent results, again, research at the American Surgical Association, which is the premier surgical association for us. Mm-hmm. And a number of the leading people in our field said, we've tried this and it didn't work. And so now we have intellectual capital. And what I mean by that is, and that's directed by Scott Holtman, our plastic surgeon, chief of plastic surgery, who also did a burn fellowship. But the idea is that the clinical protocols that have been developed are actually effective. But now we're working with the biostatisticians at UNC, Michael Kosarok and his group, to design a SMART trial, which is where you can have an intervention and then change that intervention and have comparison clinical groups. It's an extraordinarily sophisticated clinical design to analyze what are the various protocols that really produce the best possible result. Mm-hmm. And so each of these areas, the Malawi and the Burn Reconstruction Sex Center, are really opportunities for clinical and translational science on a smaller scale, in the grand scale, and even a global scale. That's really only possible at a place like UNC, where you have all of these experts who are willing to collaborate in this interdisciplinary way.
Absolutely. Well, I understand that the research component of the Burn Center, which is intrinsically part of the mission, does encompass basic clinical and translational research. What can you tell us, Bruce, about the overall goals of the research program?
So the overall goal for us is to really try to advance the clinical science. So we've developed new techniques and new tools. We've worked with industry to test new drugs and new devices, to study inhalation injury and analyze what it is that allows people to get better, and what are the various developments in immunology that might allow us to therapeutically intervene. And then use burn basic science as a way to understand what happens after burn injury. But I would submit to you, Basil Prewitt, who I had mentioned to you earlier, called burns the universal trauma model for research. And I also mentioned that burn shock was unlike any other phenomenon in medicine. My own personal hypothesis, and we have some data that bears this out, is that means you can unmask basic mechanisms of how cells work or how the immune system works by using the burn model. And most recently, we have a model using combined burn radiation, because, of course, that's a concern of the thermonuclear device, that has shown how some of the progenitors develop in the bone marrow and a role for NLRP3, which is one of the main mechanisms of how the immune response responds to stress. What's the role of that particular signaling mechanism? Because other models have really not been, maybe they're not extreme, or maybe they don't have a combination of factors that allow you to unmask that issue. So, but this requires, we just moved to the Marsico building. We work over there in microbiology immunology with Bill Goldman, the chair over there. And we appreciate being there with all of the microbiology immunologists. We have 3 graduate students, wonderful graduate students. Our lab is run by Rob Mayo, who is a PhD collaborator of mine, because obviously you have to have people that you work with and really drive that process forward. And then that allows us to collaborate with other investigators who are interested in similar phenomena. So Mark Shanefish in the Department of Chemistry has developed an ability to measure nitric oxide. So that's a device that hopefully will be clinically available. Nigel Key is someone in the hematology oncology program who studies how blood clots and is activated, and that's uniquely different in burns.
Sure.
We've worked with Sam McLean, who's in anesthesia and emergency medicine, on what are the determinants of pain and itching. And so we try to tie all of these things together. And I'd be remiss not to mention Jenny Ting on the NLRP 12 story, because she's the world's expert in that field. She's the one who has generated the mice. She's the one who's understood these. She's the one that's allowed us to create these partnerships. Mm-hmm. And so so the idea is that we try to find basic mechanisms that everybody's interested in, and then have it be applied to burns, have it be applied to translational science, and then ultimately to clinical application. And then lastly, we do burn disaster research as well, because you can't do a clinical trial and disaster response. You have to learn from your experiences. Mm-hmm. So because the people expect us, when something happens, to respond appropriately.
Right.
They want to know that we've thought about the issues, that we've trained for them, and that we have best practices in place. And some of those are really challenging. So the overall goal is to identify any and every problem that we have and try to use the scientific method to improve outcome.
And that certainly is as it should be. Well, Bruce, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about your own research program. Particularly, it looks like you focus quite a bit on the immune response.
That's right.
Which I had never really thought about before, but that's a very interesting aspect of burn injury. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. So the main complication for burn patients is they get infections. Mm-hmm. So the burn patient is in many ways immunosuppressed or immunocompromised, like a transplant patient. And what's interesting, and so therefore infections is the major cause of death, pneumonia and bloodstream infections and so forth. The immune system is also absolutely essential to wound healing and having the skin be repaired. Mm-hmm. One of the most interesting observations, though, was that Peter Medawar, who won the Nobel Prize, I think, in 1960, was the one who described the cellular mechanism for graft rejection and ushered in the era of modern transplant, both bone marrow transplants and solid organ transplants. But the way he did that was through studies of burn patients, because what was happening during the bombing of London is that patients would get burns, then the parents would donate skin to the children, then the skin would fall off, and then because it got rejected, and the parents would donate again, and it would fall off faster. And that whole mechanism is called second set graft rejection, accelerated graft rejection, which is a whole other discussion. But then I thought, well, that's kind of strange, because you're rejecting skin faster, so it seems like your immune system is more robust, yet you are immunocompromised. Why do you get infections? And so that was one of the studies that Rob and I did, was tried to understand why that occurred. And what happens is that after burn injury, there's this – it's like literally a bomb goes off. There's this activation, and then there's a contraction. In fact, the thymus disappears. But then the immune system is repopulated. But the immune system that's repopulated is not the one that was there before you got hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are more active and some of them are less active. So the process is very dynamic, which explains why some of the therapies that we've tried for sepsis have not worked, because we've been targeting the wrong thing at the wrong time, the wrong way.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And so it's very important to know what these various interactions in innate and adaptive immunity are, and then understand what your targets of opportunity are, but realize that they interact with each other. And then finally, because the skin is one of the major barriers to bacteria, how bacteria interact with the immune system after injury is also important. So we're very interested in the host-pathogen interaction. And so all of these issues are important, because you might or might not be able to intervene at a certain time with a therapeutic drug. But if you can take a snapshot of time and say, this is the status of the patient here, this is a bad time to operate, this is a bad time to harvest a skin graft,
mm-hmm.
or this is a really good time to do that, or if you don't get that burn off, you're going to have more problems. And so the idea is to connect the dots between what's happening in the immune system and what's happening with the patients.
That sounds like a very fertile ground for research. How far along in that process are you?
It's a fertile ground, but it's very complex.
Sure.
And Burns is from an NIH funding standpoint, kind of an orphan disease. Less than 1% of the NIH budget goes to trauma. Infinitesimal amount, frankly, maybe not. That's not fair. Goes to burns. There's very few burn science investigators that are clinicians, and that number is shrinking. And so we have to figure out a way to again make our case that that we're doing good science, that we're doing good fundable science. I think the approach is though going to be collaborating with people like Jenny Ting and Dave Peden, who's the runs the Center for Asthma and Lung Biology, and other people at Carolina, because I'm sure you've heard team science and big data is really where we're headed, genomics. And so we need to be a part of that. And but then also we need to not get too far afield from we're treating one person at a time.
Well, Bruce, it seems like one of the things I did want to ask you about, which you've kind of led me into, is it seems to me that it takes a very special person, a special type of person to work directly in this field in terms of patient care, which I know is part of what you do with all your spare time. is that the case? Have you seen that through the years?
So that's always an interesting observation, and my response to it has changed over time. And I'll tell you what I think about it today, because I've had opportunities to treat thousands of people with this injury and have worked with a variety of disciplines, nurses, therapists, physicians, students. And I would say that the people who are truly special are the and are in unique circumstances are the patients. They are the ones that say, I'm not a burn victim, I'm a burn victor. I've overcome. And it's really true. I resist the feeling that, well, we're particularly different because we're committed to this problem. Now, I recognize that taking care of burn patients can be difficult. For some people, it's not for them. But that's true of pediatrics. That's true of medicine. That's true of cancer. And the other reason I resist it is because I look at our board members who sacrifice so much and invest, and their passion for this is incredible. Johnny Stackhouse, for example. And so I think it's more of a recognition that this is an important problem, and these people need our help. And we need to do whatever it takes to help them. And that same philosophy is the approach that we take to Malawi, which I think that we sort of in the United States and in the West live in a bit of a bubble about what we have and don't have. I always recommend people take a trip to Malawi and see that there'd be a room as big as this studio, and there would literally be 20, 30 patients sharing 5 or 6 beds, and the families would be on the floor, and the children would be in the same bed together, and the limited resources that they have. And when you drive down the road for miles and miles and miles, people walk everywhere, and they carry all of their belongings with them. And but they're so pleasant and are really willing to work hard. What they're able to overcome is remarkable. And the same thing is true for our burn patients. I think that what we do is unique, but as long as we keep our eyes focused on why we're doing what we do, that's really what's different. And at some point, you have to pass the baton. That was true for my predecessors. That'll be true for me.
Sure.
But the mission must carry on. And so I think that, and when you take that approach, the other thing is that it's very tempting sometimes for someone to say, look what you did for someone. And I always say, well, you know, that's wonderful. I appreciate that. But I can't take credit. Because if I take credit, to be fair, then when I fail, which I fail often because it's such a challenging problem.
Sure.
And, you know, it's complex how we respond. then I better take responsibility for every one of those. Mm-hmm. No human being can do that. So we always like to take the good, but we don't always put it in a perspective with the bad. And when you take that approach, then it becomes clear we're all in this together, where we're directly taking care of the patients or we're a volunteer, or whether we're you asking, you know, allowing me to come here and share our story. It's everybody's in it together.
I could not agree more. Well, Bruce, before we run out of time for this edition of Radio In Vivo, which we're about to, I promised you I would get your thoughts about your recent election as faculty chair at UNC. Now, that is a prestigious position, and I guess you've just started it. Tell us a little bit more about that. Why did you decide to run for that post, and what are some of the duties involved?
I appreciate it, the honor and being elected by my colleagues. I really see it as an extension of service. The university, in some ways, is going through some challenging times, but in other ways, we are at the top of our game. We're in the top 10 in federal funded research. We're expanding our programs. We have the best students, the best and the brightest students coming. We have a wonderful new chancellor and new administrative team. I really think that it's about providing service to the faculty primarily, but also fundamentally to the university, students, faculty, staff, administrators, the people of the state of North Carolina, and making sure that we're doing everything we can to fulfill our mission, which in my view is really no different than what we've been talking about for the Burn Center.
Right.
Ultimately, though, the faculty chair oversees various committees. We have 27 of them. And I need to figure out how to work with them to address the problems they think are important.
Well, a new challenge for you, as if you needed another one.
Well, you know, as we talked about earlier, we whatever challenges come up is what we should take on. It wasn't my idea, I have to confess. But just because one doesn't necessarily step forward doesn't mean that you should step back when it's your turn.
Sure.
But again, in 3 years, it'll be time to pass the baton.
It'll be somebody else's turn. Okay. Well, Bruce, thank you so much for being my guest today on Radio In Vivo. All of you at the North Carolina J.C. Burn Center are doing incredibly important work, as we have heard, and on behalf of all of the citizens of North Carolina, we thank you for that.
Thanks so much, Ernie.
We've got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. You can check the website, radioinvivo.net, for our lineup of upcoming shows. And we are on Facebook, so we invite you to become a fan and stay up to date. So join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. And if you enjoy the program, we ask that you please make an effort to support the station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. One great way to do that is to log on to the WCOM website, WCOMFM.org, click on the Donate Now button, and get the details on how to make a small monthly contribution to help keep this independent voice of the community on the air. Now be sure to stay tuned for one of our most popular shows on the WCOM schedule, The Courage Cocktail with Leanne McClymont. Catch you next time. Thanks so much for listening.